enjoyed everybody's presentation. It really ties into my own teaching field, which happens to be bankruptcy, so it was interesting to hear the comparison. So I came here to learn as well as to speak. Many years ago, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, I actually had the pleasure of addressing at least some of the people on some issues of confidentiality, and some of what I will say will overlap with what I said 6 years ago, so if any of you remember it, please forgive the redundancy. But there's some extra things that I want to talk about as well, and that is the impact of confidentiality on rabbis. You know, rabbis can be in trouble, and in fact, there are insurance companies that do offer errors and omissions insurance for clergy, and I'd like to discuss some of that. But first, let me start off, just to put it in a framework that is more familiar with the people, with some of the confidentiality rules that apply to attorneys, what halakha would say about those confidentiality duties, and the dilemmas that attorneys face when halakha requires disclosure and one's legal ethics prohibit disclosure, and some examples of situations of that conflict and how one is supposed to do this. First of all, we all know, of course, the obligations of confidentiality in the attorney-client relationship. And let me just make an obvious point that those duties are premised on two distinct legal principles. One is the attorney-client privilege, which is a law of evidence that says communications that are made from a client to an attorney in an attempt to obtain legal advice are absolutely privileged, generally speaking, from mandatory disclosure in any type of legal proceeding. That is the evidentiary privilege that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, but that is very narrow. That refers to communications from the client to the attorney, and that is the attorney-client privilege. But then there is a much broader duty that is premised on legal ethics that refers to any information that an attorney obtained relating to representation of a client, whether it was from the client or from other sources. And the standard codification of that rule is the ABA Model Rule of Professional Conduct, Rule 1.6, and every state is free to adopt its own variation. Let me just read you the ABA rule, and then we'll discuss the different variations. The ABA rule says an attorney shall not reveal information relating to representation of a client unless the client consents after consultation, and violation of this rule may trigger disbarment or suspension. And again, just to make the obvious point, this is broader than the attorney-client privilege as it exists under the rule of evidence. Now, the first thing to keep in mind is that there are many times where your professional duty is to be silent and not to disclose, when your religious duty may in fact require that you do compel, that you might be compelled religiously to reveal a confidence. And in order to understand this clearly, let me first focus on the exceptions to confidentiality that are built into the model rule and to see how narrow they are. The ABA rule, and I'll start off with the ABA rule 1.6, gives a number of exceptions to the confidentiality duty. It says a lawyer may reveal a confidence to the extent that the lawyer reasonably believes that it is necessary to prevent the client from committing a criminal act that the lawyer believes is likely to result in imminent death or substantial bodily injury. Right, that is the exception that the ABA rule states. Basically, therefore, if my client told me he murdered somebody, that is a confidence that I'm not allowed to disclose. If he tells me he will murder somebody, that is a confidence that I'm duty-bound to disclose, simply because it's an exception to the confidentiality rule. However, according to this ABA rule, if my client tells me he's planning on setting on fire his warehouse to collect on insurance money, technically, that is not an exception to Rule 1.6, because Rule 1.6 is limited to a criminal act that is likely to result in death or substantial bodily injury. It's a very curious and very significant omission that if the potential prospective crime only pertains to the destruction of property, that is still covered by the absolute confidentiality rule. So, let's consider a number of examples. My client is negligently manufacturing a toy that allows children to choke on small pieces. and they're not willing to make any type of disclosure, and the Consumer Product Safety Commission has not caught on to it. Am I supposed to keep that information confidential? Answer, under the ABA rule, absolutely yes. That's what I'm saying. Therefore, it's to be kept confidential. In other words, it is not covered by the exception, because the manufacture of a dangerous product is not criminal, because at most it would only be a civil liability. I'm just giving you examples of where there is a duty of confidentiality. Example number two, my client plans to burn down a building to collect insurance money, and that is a crime that does not pose danger to life or a serious personal injury. Once again, not covered by the exception, covered by the rule, I got to keep it confidential. Yeah? Yes, I will mention the state barriers. I just want to look at the model rule for a second. Example number three. If you read the ABA rule literally, and perhaps we shouldn't read it too closely, it's not the Ten Commandments, but it does indicate that the criminal act must be contemplated by my clients. Let us assume my client informs me in the course of my representing her that her darling son is planning on committing a crime. It could very well be that even if that crime involves some serious personal injury, if it pertains to my representation of mother, it may very well be that that's still a confidence that I can't violate, because the crime would be the crime of somebody else and not the crime of the client. And of course, number four, the criminal act is prospective only, looking to the future, not looking to the past. And the classic example is, let's assume that somebody is in prison, somebody's on death row, somebody's going to be executed, and your client told you they committed the crime. There is no justification under the ABA model rule to get an innocent person off death row by saying that your client committed the crime, because that is not a future offense, that is a past offense. And getting the innocent person off the hook is not, again, under the ABA rule, is not a sufficient justification to violate confidentiality. And therefore, theoretically, an attorney could be disbarred under the ABA rule. Again, I would imagine that a disciplinary committee would have some difficulty with this, politically, if for no other reason. But theoretically, an attorney could be disbarred if he revealed confidential information to get an innocent man off death row. So the ABA rule is very, very limited in that sense. Now, let me mention right off the bat, and again, unfortunately, I was not able to look up the specific Missouri rule, and perhaps you can enlighten me, but I do want to say that there are a number of state law variations on the ABA rule that are much tougher, or to put it another way, they allow greater disclosure for criminal behavior. For example, in my own state of Maryland, as well as Alaska, New Hampshire, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania, that's the little bit of research that I did, disclosure is mandated when criminal acts are likely to result in substantial harm to financial interests as well. So therefore, we move away from the bodily injury, but even that doesn't cover all those cases. It still requires a criminal act. So that'll cover the arson case. My client tells me he wants to burn down a building. I can disclose that, but that doesn't cover the innocent man sitting on death row. That doesn't cover the toys or the dangerous substances and the like. So even with all of those modifications, a number of states have, you know, removed the requirement of death or serious personal injury, the confidentiality duty is very, very strong. And one could imagine, even as a matter of basic moral conscience, an attorney will often be struggling in a lot of these situations. You know, one possible solution, and I put that in quotation marks, is the famous anatomy of a murder solution. If you remember where Jimmy Stewart, I believe it was, didn't want the client to tell him the whole story, but he just posed a series of hypotheticals. Well, if this is what happened, you understand what the consequences are, to kind of coach the client without directly telling the attorney. But if you think about it, that's exactly the opposite of what the attorney-client privilege and confidentiality is supposed to protect, right? The classic justification of confidentiality is that legal representation can only occur in a proper way if the attorney is fully informed as to all of the factual nuances. And the theory of confidentiality is that unless clients are guaranteed a substantial measure of confidentiality, they will be deterred from either seeking legal representation, or they will be deterred from a full disclosure of the facts, and hence, because of the societal need of people to have good legal representation, confidentiality, as it were, is the augmentation. In fact, it's often said that confidentiality is necessary to fully vindicate the Sixth Amendment, at least in a criminal proceeding, to vindicate a right to counsel. Because without confidentiality, a right to counsel would simply be ineffective because of the deterrent effect. So, if we've created a situation where the only way you can satisfy your moral scruples is by not getting the client to fully disclose, you've really destroyed, in a sense, the very foundation upon which confidentiality is created. Now, let me say at the outset, whatever your version of confidentiality is, therefore, it will sometimes contradict the requirements of Jewish law. Now, the truth is, the pasuk, the verse that I want to cite, is the very verse of my earlier talk. We spoke in my earlier presentation about the famous verse in Leviticus, "Do not stand idly by your friend's blood." If you see people who are potentially going to be harmed by a crime, or an innocent man languishing in death row, or a toy that children could choke on, whether it's civil or criminal, or pollutants that are being discharged, or the marketing of firearms, or cigarettes, and you are aware of information given to you in confidence that could result in injury to third parties, under Jewish law, there would often be an obligation to speak, simply because that is the affirmative duty to rescue people from predicaments they otherwise would be in. So the classic dilemma that a religious attorney faces is, legal ethics says thou shalt be silent. Jewish ethics might require disclosure. The question then becomes, what do you do? Now, I should say at the outset that the occasional argument has been made, well, if my religion compels me to speak, then I have a right to speak under the First Amendment of the Constitution. I cannot be penalized for disclosing a confidence if my religion mandates that I disclose a confidence, because to suspend me or disbar me because I violated a rule that is a violation of my religious principles is a violation of the free exercise clause of the Constitution, meaning an attorney might have made an argument that I will do what my religion requires because of the First Amendment. Unfortunately, that is not going to wash as a matter of a legal procedure. And here the famous case to bring to mind, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, is the Smith case, an opinion by Justice Scalia. That was the peyote case. If you remember, a few years ago, there was an American Indian tribe, that uses peyote, psychedelic mushrooms, as part of their religious ceremonies, and they were being prosecuted for violation of federal narcotic laws, and their defense was that they are required by their religion to use these psychedelic substances, and therefore to imprison them for practicing their religion is a violation of their First Amendment rights. It was similar to the 19th century, the Mormon argument that they could not be prosecuted for polygamy. But what the Supreme Court ruled in Smith, which many consider to be a devastation of religious freedom, is the basic idea that as long as the state law is of general applicability and it is non-discriminatory towards religion, free exercise only protects, in an absolute sense, belief. It does not protect behavior. And although any discriminations, for example, the Supreme Court ruled, any law that bans ritual slaughtering of animals for religious ceremonies, where it doesn't ban slaughtering for non-religious reasons, is indeed a violation of the First Amendment. So you couldn't pass a law that says you can't slaughter a goat for a sacrifice if you're allowed to slaughter a goat for regular eating. But as long as it's of general applicability, the fact that it burdens your particular religious observance does not give rise to a constitutional claim. That is called the Smith Doctrine, and you know, many in the Jewish community were very afraid because that, in effect, could go back to all sorts of things. For example, let's assume a state would pass a law mandating an autopsy for death by suspicious circumstances without allowing for any exception because of religious reasons. Most states do allow religious exemptions, but under Smith, they would not have to allow a religious exemption because it's a law of general neutrality. Yeah.
Yes,
I'll address that. Now, Congress tried to overrule Smith by passing a federal statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, often called RFRA, which would have said that any state or federal law that burdens religious observance would only be valid if it serves a compelling state interest, and the neutral applicability test would not be enough. However, the Supreme Court of the United States said that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is unconstitutional as it applies to state law. It could apply to federal law, because Congress can do whatever it wants, but Congress is empowered to strike down state law only if it's in furtherance of enforcing the constitutional amendment. And since this goes beyond the parameters of free exercise, they could not. So RFRA is actually unconstitutional. And where this leaves us, just again, to relate this to the Jewish law construct, so where this leaves us is, any attorney who makes the arguments that I cannot be penalized for disclosure because I am exercising my free exercise rights and it is unconstitutional to sanction me because I have followed my religious principles is going to lose that case because of Smith and because of the unconstitutionality of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, this could work in D.C., or Guam, or American Samoa, because those are governed by federal law, and RFRA is a legitimate exercise of congressional power over federal territories, and you might argue if there's no compelling state interest, which I'll address, to give me to penalize me, then, you know, I can go ahead and do it, but as I say, there's still going to be a problem. I'm sorry, yes, sir?
Isn't there some aspect of a waiver here, though, when you accept your law license, and you take an oath in an integrated bar like Missouri, it seems to me you're subjecting yourself to the Missouri Supreme Court and the disciplinary council.
Yes.
And you're waiving a lot of those arguments by reason of that action.
Yeah, so here's where we get into a complicated argument, meaning to say, you know, duties that are owed to God as a matter of religion are strictly speaking non-waivable. Now, where you might come out with your analysis is the following. I haven't waived my duties to God, but I've waived the immunity of claiming I can't be punished for it. I think you do have a point. In other words, it would be akin to a civil disobedience type of problem, meaning I can't waive myself out of my duty, but I can waive myself out of the ability to claim an advantage based on my duty. So I think you do have a point there. Which might very well defeat a free exercise claim even without Smith. But the long and the short of it is, because of the Smith case, a free exercise claim to be able to disclose is very, very likely to fail. Yeah.
But I'm talking about not being able to dispute it.
Well, that's where I would argue that you can't waive. In other words, if Jewish law says you are supposed to disclose, you cannot, by God's law, waive your duty to disclosure by opting into a confidentiality system. Because, you know, you're not a party to waive God's duties upon you. So, No. I would say it would fail, perhaps, to get out of a sanction. Meaning to say, you can't waive your duty to speak. You must speak. However, you can waive your privilege not to be penalized for speaking, because essentially it's like a civil disobedience situation where you violate an unjust law, but you got to be willing to take the consequences. So there I would agree with you that you can waive your immunity, but you can't waive your duty to God to speak when it's necessary to speak. You'll be like the Martin Luther King, kind of just taking the consequences of violating that's unjust law. Now there is another approach, and if you remember, I mentioned that in order to save a person, you don't have to give up all of your fortune etc. So the argument might be, some have made the argument, that if you're going to face, by violating confidentiality, disbarment, which is potential loss of income and professional license, that would itself give you a cap in terms of being able to keep silence. In other words, it would be the probable consequences. Again, though, that would depend on a case by case. I mean, I remember when I was in law school, this was a while ago, there was a case in New York where I think two children were missing and the parents didn't know if they were dead or alive. And client comes to attorney and says, you know, I did it. And he took the attorney to the grave. It was a shallow grave somewhere in upstate New York. And the attorney was in an awful quandary because the parents here are suffering this agony of not knowing if their kids are dead or alive. Now, if the attorney openly reveals the information, they'll know who his client is. So the attorney, what the attorney actually did was he made a confidential call. In other words, a secret call to the parents without revealing who he was. But the truth of the matter is, that also is a compromising of confidentiality, simply because obviously once a body is recovered, there's all sorts of forensic evidence that can be obtained, which can be used to his client's conviction. So I believe that somehow the bar authorities figured out that this attorney was the source of the information, and I believe a disciplinary proceeding was commenced. I'm not sure how it came out. So the point there is that even if you communicate in a way that they don't know that it's you, you can still face that loss of income and the like. So that might be one way out. But my point basically is that the First Amendment, per se, is not going to be a direct protection. However, in a lecture, Justice Brennan, the late Justice Brennan, one of the, whether you agree with him or not, he was certainly one of the very, very influential judges in the Supreme Court in the latter half of the 20th century. He was the liberal leader of the Warren Court. He was the intellectual liberal leader of the Warren Court, and he managed toward the end of his life to be faced with a Supreme Court that was increasingly conservative under Berger and then Rehnquist, and all of the constitutional edifice that he had been constructing was being emasculated brick by brick by brick. So in a famous lecture at NYU, Justice Brennan started advocating that since he was losing his positions on the U.S. Supreme Court, he started advocating that state courts start using their state constitutions to expand constitutional rights, even as the federal constitution is being emasculated. In other words, you have a situation where let's assume that the federal constitution and the First Amendment guarantees freedom of religion. And then you have a state constitution that says the same thing. But if a state court says, we find that a given practice is a violation of our state constitution, then theoretically that immunizes it from Supreme Court review, because the Supreme Court has no authority to overrule a constitutional judgment predicated on a state constitution. So Brennan basically gave the message, if you're a liberal judge who wants to expand constitutional rights, he was giving the hint to the state judiciary, predicate your findings on a state constitution rather than a federal constitution, and therefore you'll keep the case out of the grubby little paws of the nine old men or the six old men who are going to destroy all of these wonderful constitutional rights. And in truth, it must be said, and again, I'm sorry I can't speak to Missouri directly, that in a number of state constitutions, the freedom of religion rights are actually more expansive than they are under the federal constitution after Smith, and many of them adopt what used to be the federal standard before Smith, and that is what is called the compelling state or compelling governmental interest test. That is no longer the test under federal constitutional free exercise claims. That is what RAFRA tried to reintroduce. That was struck down, but many state constitutions preserve it. Now, what is that standard? So very briefly, the standard basically is that if a governmental practice imposes a substantial burden on religious observance, it will be struck down unless the government can show both that the need for that rule serves what is called a compelling governmental interest, and there is no lesser restrictive way that could advance that interest. That is the compelling state interest test. That is not the test under Smith, but under some state constitutions, that is the test. For example, just mentioned some states, Alaska, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nebraska, Ohio, Virginia, Vermont, and the state of Washington. Now, what is a compelling state interest? It's hard to find because, you know, it has no intrinsic definition. I mean, one of the reasons con law is a very frustrating subject is, you know, that's why I like UCC and bankruptcy, because, you know, you get definite answers to definite questions. In con law, we are filled with these nebulous terms of compelling state interests and all that other stuff, which have no intrinsic definition other than it got to be very important. And if you look in the Supreme Court opinions, you will find that very few things are considered to be compelling state interests. Generally, they have tended to be racial equality and tax collection. Those are the two interests that the Supreme Court has identified as compelling. Anything short of that generally has not been. One can at least make an argument that perhaps confidentiality per se may not be a compelling state interest. Judge Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit, also a Jewish judge who is somewhat conversant with Jewish law as well, has suggested that perhaps if religious attorneys tell their clients up front through disclosure that although I will keep your confidences, there are times in which I need to disclose, although one wonders what impact that's going to have. The person might just walk out of the door. Judge Kaczynski suggests there is certainly no compelling interest to penalize an attorney who, after that type of advanced disclosure, revealed. So he suggests in some cases a First Amendment claim might be available. But basically, that is a basic summary of the conflict between confidentiality as required by legal ethics and the duty of disclosure that is sometimes required by Jewish law. And the point that I want to make is the First Amendment is not going to be a very helpful argument for the attorney simply because of the Smith case. However, there might be some basis for relief under the state constitutions if you could invoke a compelling state interest requirement. Now, let me move, though, a little bit into the main issue I want to address, and that is how does that work in the context of rabbis, clergymen, same thing with priests. Now, just as there is an attorney-client privilege, an evidentiary privilege, there is in all states a clergyman-penitent privilege, that it is called. And I'm not referring to the religious doctrine, for example, of Catholicism that talks about confessions as being inviolate. That's a religious law. But there is a secular law that one who communicates to their clergyman for the purpose is very important, for the purpose of obtaining spiritual guidance, is entitled to protection of that communication. That communication may not be revealed. It is not subject to mandatory disclosure. This is a rule of evidence, the clergyman penitent provision. Obviously, it had its origin in ecclesiastical law, but even though in Judaism the concept of the confession is unknown, you don't go to a rabbi in terms of confession. I mean, you can go to a rabbi and you can discuss your life and what you should do about it, but tshuva, which is repentance, is a very personal thing. You do repentance to God, or with God. You don't, as it were, have the rabbi absolve you. But there is this evidentiary privilege. However, once again, it only applies if you speak to your clergyman for the purpose of getting spiritual counsel. And that's always going to be a threshold issue. Sometimes a person might go to his rabbi because his rabbi is his next-door neighbor, or his rabbi is his friend, or his rabbi is a businessman, because rabbis, you know, tend not to only be rabbis, they tend to have other things they do as well. And the issue is going to be, you know, I remember somebody went to a prominent rabbi in Muncie. He ran the story. He just said he murdered his wife, etc., and he wanted to know, like, how he could get away, or whatever it is. And the rabbi just went into the next room, called up the police, and there was a motion to suppress the evidence on the grounds that it was a violation of the clergyman penitent privilege. And the short answer was, he wasn't coming for penitence, he was coming for escape, and therefore that is not covered by spiritual guidance. So that's going to be an issue. But there is that evidentiary privilege. So let me share with you a recent case in New York, which involved a very prominent, well-known, respected rather, that I know personally. And the situation was that a woman went to this rabbi, and she was seeking counseling in the matter of her marriage. It wasn't going too well. And in the course of the discussion, this was an Orthodox woman, she indicated that she was seeing other people socially. Again, it's not clear from the opinion whether she was actually having an affair or not. And that she had stopped observing the Jewish family purity laws. As you know, among the Orthodox, during a woman's menstrual time of the month, sexual relations are prohibited, and she must go to a special ritual bath every month to resume marital status. And she had indicated that she was no longer keeping those particular laws, but she also indicated, which I think is very important, that therefore she was not having sexual relations with her husband. I think that's extremely important against what the rabbi did, and I'll discuss that as we go on. Well, in the meantime, there's a civil divorce proceeding going on, and the rabbi immediately had told the husband about the conversation he had with the wife, and the husband then requested that the rabbi submit an affidavit . And what the woman then did, well, I don't know how the custody hearing came out, that's not recorded, but the woman then filed a civil action against the rabbi, alleging a number of things. Number one, alleging breach of the clergyman-penitent confidentiality rule. And number two, alleging invasion of privacy, which in New York could be a tort. And number three, alleging intentional infliction of emotional distress, and number four, alleging defamation. One of her arguments was that something the rabbi said was just not true, and therefore she brought a defamation action. Actually, it was against two rabbis, but then the rabbi filed a motion for summary judgment, or a motion to dismiss, and the court denied the motion to dismiss and held the matter for trial. That's where it is right now. Now, you can imagine this kind of created shockwaves among the rabbinical community because, you know, people were hoping they would just dismiss it and say there was no cause of action. The court basically said that it can't grant judgment for plaintiff because there are all sorts of other issues, such as she communicated to the rabbi in the presence of a friend. Was that a waiver of confidentiality? But the court refused to grant the motion to dismiss. This case is Lightman versus Flom. Flom is actually the rabbi. The only thing the court did do is the court did dismiss the defamation case as a matter of law, because under the state law of defamation, there is an absolute privilege for statements that are made in the context of a judicial proceeding. So the defamation procedure, the defamation clause was dismissed, but everything else was able to stand. Now, let's look at this a bit more carefully and see why this is such an important opinion. First of all, the court recognized for the first time that the breach of that evidentiary privilege gives rise to an action for damages. Now, that itself doesn't follow at all. Generally speaking, an evidentiary privilege simply means that the information cannot be introduced into evidence. So the appropriate thing that Mrs. Lightman could have done was to file a motion to suppress, and that would be fine. But here we see that the privilege is no longer a shield, or only a shield, the privilege is a sword. In other words, clergyman breaches privilege, the rule is a person can get damages based on that breach of privilege. Yeah?
That's nothing new, though. If the doctor violates the patient,
yes.
Right,
no, that is correct. In fact, what the court basically said was, although there was no authority on point that a breach of the clergy-penitent privilege gives rise to damages, the court drew exactly the analogies you're talking about, that the breach of other evidentiary privileges does give rise to a cause of action. The court also said that this was so despicable, in fact, it was a funny thing, the judge was a Jewish judge, David Goldstein, and he wrote at great length that he found the rabbinical behavior so despicable and outrageous that he considered this to be intentional infliction of emotional distress, which, as you know, hard to define, but it got to be pretty bad. Meaning to say, it has to be outrageous, shocking the conscience, and everything else. So the court allowed that, plus invasion of privacy, and the like. But what is interesting is, the court then dealt with the First Amendment issue. Because Rabbi Fromm claims that he was obligated under Jewish law to make those disclosures. Now, I have to say, in some way, that if I were to analyze this as a Jewish law matter, and again, I have tremendous respect for Rabbi Fromm, he's a very eminent rabbi, but I have to say that from a Jewish law standpoint, it's not clear why disclosure would even be mandated. Let me give you two scenarios. Scenario number one is, wife goes to rabbi and says, I'm no longer keeping the laws of family purity, but I'm not telling my husband. Now, and then we're still having sexual relations. Now there, a very strong argument could be made that a rabbi has an affirmative duty to tell the husband. Because analogous, although you think it's very different, analogous to the AIDS patient that says, I'm going to have unprotected sex, in which case confidentiality clearly doesn't apply even under secular law because of the imminent danger to someone. Well, Jewish law regards spiritual transgression as bad as physical danger. So if she said, I'm going to have relations with my husband and I'm not going to keep the laws of family purity, one could make a halachic argument that a rabbi in the discharge of his spiritual duties would have to reveal that. But the key point that emerges here is that the woman said to the rabbi that, you know, we no longer have sexual relations. So it turns out that whether she goes or doesn't go to the through this ritual, there is no aveira, there is no sin, there is no transgression that's being committed. So where is that duty of disclosure? Second of all, even if Rabbi Fromm is correct that there is a duty of disclosure, that would be limited to the husband. Now, of course, once the husband knows the information, he can use it in some way, but what would be the justification for the rabbi to actively participate without subpoena in the court proceeding by filing an affidavit? Now, Rabbi Fromm made another argument. He said, well, his religious duty is to ensure that the children do not get raised in an environment where the mother does not want to keep Jewish law. Well, the truth of the matter is, it's very unlikely that that would have been a major factor in the custody disposition anyway. So in effect, he's shooting at a red herring because that wouldn't have made a difference. So consequently, Rabbi Flom's arguments, and again, he's a very, very eminent person, and he may very well have considerations that I'm not aware of, but his halakhic argument appears to be weak, and the judge took this position, which, by the way, is a little strange, because, in fact, I'll discuss, one could argue that although I think the judge was correct, institutionally, it was not his role to interpret Jewish law. And basically, you have a judge that's saying, I disagree with this rabbi's interpretation of Jewish law. I happen to believe the judge was correct, but institutionally that's irrelevant. And let me show you why that's a problem, because let me compare this to another case in the state of New York that was decided just very recently, the year 2000. And this involved, and it's very funny because in the state of New York, apparently violating a confidence is more serious than sexual abuse. This involved a Roman Catholic priest who was counseling a woman that was getting multiple sclerosis. And obviously she was afraid, she was scared, she saw herself dying. And this priest came over to offer her spiritual guidance and solace. And in the course of the relationship, he initiated sexual overtures, which she tried to repel, but there was no rape involved, but eventually there was some consensual relationship. He was also instrumental in the breakup of her marriage, because he would tell her husband that she doesn't love you anymore, and etc. And eventually the marriage broke up as a result of this priest's spiritual counseling. And she eventually went to a therapist, and the therapist convinced her that she was really being manipulated here, and she finally broke off. Again, it's a very sad story, so she's without a marriage, her health is deteriorating, she's all alone. She brought an action against the diocese and the priest on the grounds of clerical malpractice, meaning he was failing to comply with the duty of practicing the profession properly, and therefore it was actionable as a malpractice suit. Well, in the state of New York, the Supreme Court of New York, which is only the trial court, actually said that it would be an excessive entanglement of religion for a court to define what the proper standard of care of a clergyman is. Because after all, you know, who knows? It's one thing if he had committed a crime, if he had raped her, of course there could be criminal prosecution. But in terms of, you know, there was no crime here, all sexual overtures were ultimately consensual, there was manipulation, there was undue influence, but the court said, for us to define what is the proper way a spiritual leader discharges his duties would be an excessive entanglement in ecclesiastical doctrine, and therefore it would be a violation. Actually, this is not a free exercise issue, this is an Establishment Clause issue. Under the Establishment Clause, one of the things secular courts cannot do is resolve ecclesiastical machloket, in other words, arguments. In other words, if there's an argument between Maimonides and Nachmanides, a judge, even if he happens to be a rabbi as well, a judge in a judicial opinion is constitutionally prohibited from resolving a halachic matter. And consequently, the court took the position that whether sexual manipulation of this nature, non-criminal sexual manipulation, is a defalcation, as it were, of the duties of a clergyman, cannot be determined by a secular court. Now,
the opinion, expert testimony from other priests?
No. He took the position you could not, because he took the position that that was an internal doctrinal matter, and the court is not supposed to decide it. Now, what's interesting is, so, gee, you read these two cases, and here it's a little funny. We have the disclosure of a confidence, which we might think on some level isn't as bad as what the Roman Catholic priest did. And there, the judge is perfectly willing to get into Jewish law and say, hey, Rabbi Flam, you didn't have to disclose it because she said she wasn't having relations with her husband, so no sin was committed.
There's a big difference.
Yeah.
Rabbi Flam is raising a defense under the state fellow compelling interest. I think you said New York was one of those states that had the law.
Yeah,
so that gives the court jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Raising that defense in this state court, the judge therefore has the right to determine.
Yeah, but it's the same thing here, because she is bringing an action based on malpractice, clerical malpractice.
Correct. The court just said we're
no, but it's the same
thing. Recognize a cause of action for the plaintiff for this clerical malpractice.
Oh, okay.
The rabbi raising the defense within the confines of...
Yeah, well, one thing, but in both cases, it's the so-called beneficiary of the counseling. It is the person who came to the clergyman seeking religious advice that is bringing an action. In one case, it's a woman that is bringing an action based on breach of confidentiality. In the other case, it's a woman that's bringing an action based on malpractice. Now, what the court did say is, really, I think you have a good point. What the court did say is, well, malpractice is predicated on defining a standard of care. And what is an appropriate standard of care is something that each religion must define by itself, and we're not going to get involved in telling religions what a standard of care is. Here, we're not focusing in Flam versus Lightman, we're not focusing on standard of care, we're focusing on a very specific duty of confidentiality, which is not limited to religious leaders, but it applies to other analogous professionals, doctors, lawyers, accountants, and the like, and therefore we're simply imposing a neutral rule that does not require the resolution of ecclesiastical doctrine. Well, you know, I can hear that in theory, but you know, the bottom line is a very strange, perhaps, if not bizarre line, and that is, you breach a confidence, you can be in big trouble, you commit sexual abuse, you know, the court does not recognize a cause of action for clerical malpractice. Now, these are two different, these are both low-level opinions. These are both Supreme Court, trial court opinions, and it'd be interesting to see what the Court of Appeals will do when it comes up. Yes?
A great many clergymen have no idea how much or how many these days are also trained in psychotherapy in some.
Yes. That's a very,
treated as malpractice in counseling or psychotherapy.
Yeah, that's a very, very difficult thing. You know, like I'm a rabbi and a lawyer, for example. So it would be fairly easy for me to distinguish spiritual advice from legal advice. When you're dealing in the realm of psychotherapy, that's a very, very nebulous distinction, because a lot of what the rabbi would be offering as spiritual pertains to realization of potential and all that stuff, which ties into psychological advice as well. I mean, a lot of spiritual advice is psychological advice. It would be difficult, of course, both are governed by confidentiality, but the question becomes that one thing does not involve ecclesiastical doctrine and the other does. It would be very hard. It would be very hard. And I know that...
Does it become just a matter of pleading?
Well, I think that we would have to go beyond the labels. And of course, I'll give you a more prosaic context. I have a rabbi friend who's a psychologist, and as a psychologist, he charges people a fee. As a rabbi, it's part of his salary as a rabbi. So he had some problems. What happens when members come to him for advice? Does it depend where he meets them? You know, I meet you in my rabbi's office. You know, you're a rabbi. I'm a rabbi congregant. I meet you at downtown. You know, a psychologist, you know, does it depend on where you go? Like, is that going to be an important distinction? But that is a good point. At some point, what is spiritual advice is very difficult. And of course, you know that psychologists and therapists have been held. The famous Tarasov case actually did hold that psychologists were liable for negligent counseling if that resulted in somebody's suicide. Right? So there is that type of liability. So I just wanted to call to your attention the Flom versus Lightman case as compared to the Langstrom case, which is the Roman Catholic sexual abuse. And now, if you ever look up that case, you have to be very careful. The first time I read it wrong, because most of the case is actually a dissent by a woman judge. I thought when I first read it, I thought that was the case. And the dissent argues very strenuously, hey, we don't have to get into subtle theological debates in terms that a priest that is sexually abusing somebody, you know, is violating a standard. In other words, be realistic here. It's true that you have to define a standard of care, but, you know, something that is so grossly beyond the pale of decency should be clear enough. When I first read it, I thought that was the opinion. That is the dissent. The opinion actually granted a motion to dismiss.
This would be... Yeah. Dealt with on the pleadings.
That's correct. This was dismissed on the pleadings. That is correct. So Flom, as opposed to the Langstrom, I think creates an interesting dichotomy as to confidentiality. Now let me mention one final case that came up about clerical malpractice. Let me find my notes here. This was a case that arose in Muncie, New York. Klangsrum, and it's a little complicated. Let me introduce a little bit of Jewish divorce law so you get the idea. As many of you know, a marriage under Jewish law is not terminated with a civil divorce. Even if the parties are civilly divorced, if they went through a Jewish marriage, they are still married to each other in the eyes of Judaism until there is what is called a get. A get is a document, a handwritten document written by a Jewish scribe, and the man, signed by witnesses, it's written in Hebrew and Aramaic, and the man or his agent delivers the document to the woman or her agent, and upon delivery of that piece of paper, she is now halachically divorced and allowed to marry another man. If she does not get that piece of paper, no matter what we've done civilly, she is not allowed in the eyes of Jewish law to marry another person. In the eyes of Jewish law, that marriage is adulterous. And as many of you know, there have been many, many instances of men who have spitefully withheld that piece of paper as a matter of getting concessions, money, child support, child custody, or the like. And that is the name of a whole problem in Jewish law called aguna, Aguna means the anchored wife, and you know, there are different issues of how we deal with that. Well, under Jewish law, however, until a man divorces his wife with a get, he's not allowed to marry another wife. Right? Polygamy is a prohibited practice under Jewish law. It was not always that case. Now, until the 11th century, polygamy was permissible under Jewish law, but it became forbidden by rabbinic enactment. So what happened in the city of Muncie was, a man had gotten a civil divorce, he had refused to give his wife a get, but he simply married another woman civilly and is living together in Muncie, and when the rabbis questioned him on it, he basically said, well, some anonymous rabbis that he refused to name gave me permission to do this, therefore I'm allowed to do this. Well, the local rabbi in Muncie investigated, and they saw that there was no substance to what he said, so they issued a proclamation. Now, a Jewish rabbinical court, if you're a member, you know, if you subscribe to the Orthodox community, can actually excommunicate you, or basically say you don't have synagogue honors, or shunning. It's not exactly the same as the Amish do, but it's a similar type of ostracism that is involved. So essentially they issued a statement that this man is not obeying Jewish law, he is refusing to treat his wife with decency, therefore we hereby declare him to be in contempt of our communal norms, and the community should not give him any religious recognition in the institutions. This was also circulated on the internet, although the rabbis absolutely denied that they put it on the internet. And I believe them. They circulated it locally in Muncie, and then, of course, somebody put it on the net, which is really a whole new basis of dissemination of all sorts of information, good or bad. Well, this guy was fairly aggressive, and he brought a defamation action against the Beit Din, because he claimed that their statements were untrue. Now, the Beit Din could have countered with two defenses under state law, but this would necessitate trial. Their first defense would have been truth. Truth is an absolute defense in a libel action, and therefore they could have just alleged truth, but truth would require a trial on the merits. And the other defense that they could have articulated is a bit more complicated, and that is a defense of qualified privilege. And that simply means, for example, if I have information which I believe is true, even if it turns out not to be true, I limit disclosure to those who have a need to know, even if it turns out to be defamatory, there's a qualified privilege. So at least with respect to notifying the local community, they could have claimed qualified privilege, but that too would have required a trial as to whether they acted with malice or not with malice, and whether they limited the disclosure to those in the right to know. Instead, the rabbis chose not to assert defenses based on truth, or defenses based on qualified privilege. They invoked a constitutional law defense, and they wanted a dismissal on the pleadings because they alleged that determining whether their statements were true or false would involve a secular court in the determination of ecclesiastical doctrine, and therefore a court could not even judge the truth or falsity of the defamation, because that would be an excessive entanglement in religious doctrine. Well, the court granted the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim by accepting the entanglement doctrine. Now, let me explain why the court did this. Basically, the issue was, the man claimed under Jewish law, polygamy was permitted in his circumstances. The rabbis claimed it wasn't. Now, in Jewish law, that involves a halachic question, and therefore the court said, for them to judge whether something was halachically right or not halachically right would get the court involved in ecclesiastical disputes, and therefore the First Amendment prohibited that inquiry. It's similar to the Langstrom reasoning, that a court is not going to define, you know, what is proper clerical counseling and the like. Now, it's important to know, though, the following, that it seems that the court is not immunizing rabbis from defamation suits. It all depends on whether an objective fact was stated or something that would require halachic judgment, meaning to say the following. Let's assume that the rabbis made a statement, we will ostracize this man because he beats his wife. They made a factual allegation. It would appear that to decide whether that is true or that is false requires a court to engage in fact-finding of an objective nature that does not get the court involved in ecclesiastical disputes. So under those circumstances, the only defense the rabbi would have would either be truth or qualified privilege if they had a good faith belief that it was true and they limited their disclosure to people who had a need to know. By contrast, see, these are two different statements. A statement, he beats his wife, and a statement, it is a halachic violation for somebody to commit polygamy, are two different types of statements. One is a statement of fact, which is susceptible to judicial fact-finding, and the other is an ecclesiastical judgment. We would call it a question of law, but it's a question of religious law, which is beyond the purview of a secular judge under the First Amendment. So one should understand, therefore, that the Klangsbrenn case should not be read as an immunization of the clergy from defamation actions, but only when those defamation actions require law standards to determine their truth or their falsity. So again, I find it interesting that this trilogy of New York cases is very, very instructive. We have the Lightman versus Flom case, which involves the breach of confidentiality, which is actionable in the state of New York. We have the sexual abuse case where the court refused to recognize clerical malpractice on the grounds that the very formulation of a standard would require a resolution of ecclesiastical doctrine. And we have the Klangsbrenn case, which in the context of defamation, the courts made a similar point that if the truth or falsity of a statement is dependent on ecclesiastical doctrine, a court cannot get involved. Let me give you another example. And this happened in Baltimore. Now, Maryland had a kosher labeling law, meaning to say, if you labeled your products as kosher and it turned out they were not kosher, you could be subject to a civil penalty for violating the kosher law. And they hired an Orthodox rabbi as an inspector to determine that things were kosher or not kosher. Now, here's the problem. There was a fellow, actually he was an Arab vendor, who was selling kosher hot dogs, but he was grilling them on the same grill as non-kosher hot dogs. Now, under Jewish law, those kosher hot dogs are now non-kosher because they absorb, you know, the grease of the non-kosher hot dog. But the Arab vendor said that it's unconstitutional for the state to determine what is kosher and what is not kosher because that is an ecclesiastical issue. And courts are not supposed to resolve ecclesiastical issues. Well, you know, the person won. The person won. The law was struck down as a violation of the Establishment Clause because there are different interpretations of kosher. You know, Reformed Jews define kosher one way, and Orthodox Jews define kosher another way, and there are different levels of Orthodox observance. I would feel one is right and one is wrong, but once again, it is not the role of a court to determine that. So if, on the other hand, therefore, any law that requires that the court consider the meaning of religious doctrine may run afoul of the Establishment Clause, but that's not the same when there's objective criteria that can be established by neutral fact-finding. So a statement, your food is not kosher, is not the same as a statement, you beat your wife. One is susceptible to judicial fact-finding, and one is not. So once again, though, I think the bottom line is that at least in the state of New York, and I would imagine this would be followed in other states as well, the disclosure of confidences by clergymen is taken very, very seriously and can give rise to significant damage liability. And unless you can make a compelling state argument based on a state constitution, even if halakha mandates your disclosure, which I believe it did not in Rabbi Flom's case, but even if it mandates a disclosure, the rabbi has to know that he will face the consequences of potential damage liability simply because under the Smith case, the compelling state interest is not the standard. As long as there's a mutual confidentiality rule applying to all professionals in discrete relationships, that law is going to survive a First Amendment attack. So the First Amendment cannot really be used to add that confidentiality requirements. That doesn't mean you don't obey Jewish law. You must obey Jewish law if you're a committed Jew. It does mean that there's no free lunch. There's no guarantee that you will not be penalized. And once again, well, that's an example of martyrdom for the faith, and Jewish law may often require that. Of course, what that might mean is, that might mean that part of rabbinical negotiation is to negotiate favorable insurance policies for errors and omissions, although it's not clear to me that intentional breach of confidentiality would even be covered by an insurance policy, because that's an intentional violation of a duty to care. So I guess I'm about finished. If there's any questions or comments. Okay, well, thank you very much. It was good to see you again. And see you.
Graduation form.